Tovární hlášení ve vašem éteru.
Hi, thanks for coming and thanks for waiting a bit. We're having the usual sort of complications of technical things that we had to get for the show, but we fixed it. So that's good. My name's Craig Leon. What I'm supposed to talk about today is what I'm going to talk about today is the influence of the music that I experienced in New York in the 1970s and how it's been carried into new places and the influences on what even caused it. I don't know if people are that aware of it, but I'll speak about it. I first got to New York in the early 1970s. And I was working for a record company. What I'm going to do is talk about the whole musical scene of New York is too much for us for just this one video. There were many, many enclaves in the 70s of sound that all made a lot of what influenced music as it is today. But I'm going to try and dwell on the influences from New York to the people that were actually living and making music at that time in New York. You had the music experience that I had and the bands and artists that I'm going to focus on were the ones that were living in the south of the island, Greenwich Village and below. Greenwich Village was a focal point of folk music in the 1950s and 60s and before, and was a great hotbed of political activity as well. And it gathered together a number of performers who started learning all sorts of roots American music and applying it to their own way of life. It was all rooted to begin with. What starts the modern era of it is in 1951, LPs were just going to be made. And somebody made an LP set called the Anthology of American Folk Music, which was, from a record collector's viewpoint, he had 40,000 records from the old 78s. And he went to a record company and took the best of them, and he put them in a compilation of what he thought was the mindset of America at that time. And this becomes important later on. But why I'm telling you this now is that was one of the first LPs that a lot of people had. And pre the time that I was in New York, a lot of the people in the New York folk scene learned what they needed to learn and learned how to write and express themselves from the songs that were on this compilation of these four LPs. And it was an LP compilation where the guy was trying to prove, his name was Harry Smith, and he was a noted wacko in New York, and beyond that, a very intellectual man and a great record collector and music collector and folklore collector. So in any case, you had this group of songs that all of a sudden was on the turntable of everybody in Greenwich Village. And all the people that migrated because they heard these songs were the people like Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, Phil Oakes, what became the protest scene of the 60s, Paul Simon, many of those people. And that influenced the general bearing of New York music at that time. And Harry Smith went on to even produce some New York bands, one of which was called the Village Fugs, which was still going these days as the Fugs. And they were influential on being radical and punk at that time, even though they were a folk band. And this is about 1966. They were doing things that got them in trouble, songs that got them banned from the radio. They were put in jail for protests. They did all sorts of crazy things like that, but good things that actually influenced people that came later. Younger people that were listening to this and who came to it started bands in New York that were more in the spirit of this band and this feeling and the local sounds of New York, which were this, the hip-hop scene starting from up in the north of the island, and then the New York jazz scene, and the Latin scene. All of those three scenes together created disco music, which actually became an important part of the electronic music that we're talking about right now. And that also influenced people in the downtown music scene. The downtown music scene was originally avant-garde electronic people for the most part, other than the Fugs. It was bands like Silver Apples, who were the ancestors of a band I produced in the 70s called Suicide. They were a very big influence on them, which was a two-person electronic band, which carried the format of what we now know as electronic pop music. You know, with that band, Suicide, influenced a lot of the bands later that came from England, like Depeche Mode and such, and Mark Almond and bands like that. But they were also influenced by German technological music as well. And so there was this big circle that happened because media was getting more broad and people could hear things from other places. Back when I got to New York in the 1970s, we usually could only hear things from records, and we'd have to borrow them or hear them or get them on the radio or whatever. We didn't have the internet, obviously, and that was it. But what was happening is people were getting interested in the roots of what was happening, particularly in New York at that time, and they were starting their bands and their musical careers based on that. There was a heavy avant-garde scene down in the south of the island that was not a lot of people, but there were a lot of good people were involved in it. People like Tony Conrad, who you may have heard of, and such, and a number of other artists. Robert Margoloff, who had a band called Tonto's Expanding Headband that played at that time. They used to play at a club called The Kitchen. And that band, John Cale, came out of, Lamont Young came out of. Those guys were the formation of when they decided to put together a band for Andy Warhol, who was an artist like that in New York. That's what the Velvet Underground came out of, was that whole scene with a heavy influence on traditional rock. And that's prompted a lot of artists in New York to start bands, and of people from around the country that heard it, to come to New York and start playing music like that. Some of the bands we'll skip over to the time. There were bands before. There were artists like the New York Dolls, who were influenced by English music as well as all of that. There were artists like the Magic Tramps, but I'm talking to you about names that you probably haven't heard that much. But in any case, the first ones came out of this triangle of clubs in New York that drew a lot of national attention eventually and started people off doing music of their own. And they created music back and forth to each other based on hearing this music, very similar to what happened with Harry Smith that we just spoke about and his anthology. So you would have somebody listen to the Velvet Underground and say, well, I can make something like that. And what does it say to me? And I'm a poet. So we have an artist like Patti Smith who emerged, who was very heavily from that scene, and who was giving poetry readings and recital readings with a young guitar player named Lenny Kaye. And they actually were starting to fuse the avant-garde scene with rock and roll, like the Fugs had done in the 60s. Excuse me. What had happened then was that the traditional rock and roll and pop music of that time, which was very influential in the counterculture of the time of then, you'd have to have been there to know what I'm talking about, because it's inconceivable with the internet of today how segregated all the musical tastes were. You would have artists who, if they liked one form of music, wouldn't listen to another. You know, it was just unbelievable. You have people that, you know, it was really radical for a pop or a rock artist or a folk artist to listen to disco music, which was basically electronic music eventually, soul music and electronic music put together. So what happened was is these things started molding together. One of the first bands that I encountered in New York was in 1973, if I'm not mistaken, I'm bad on dates, was the two-piece band Suicide. They were probably the first band I heard. I don't know. Are you aware of Suicide? You guys have to be. Okay, that's where we start getting aware of this. Alan and Marty were two guys that even early on in those early Harry Smith days were formulating their own art avant-garde music, the type of stuff that permeates these festivals now. And they were very, very early on it, and they got ridiculed and banned from places for playing what they did and had absolutely no following whatsoever at first. I saw them in a club that had maybe three or four other people in the audience with me. They were headlining over a band. A record company sent me to go see a band to see if I should sign them and give them a record deal. And it was a bad imitation of English glam rock. But I said, look, Suicide is the opening act was this band. The headliner, who had literally about three people there, was Suicide. And they said, the people said, you're not going to believe this. Don't sit near the front of the stage. But I didn't know. I said, okay, I'll go back in the back. I won't sit there. The two guys came out. They started playing. Alan, the singer, started doing wild James Brown steps and started fusing all those traditions that I just mentioned earlier into his set with this one guy who was a stonewall of electronics. And the stonewall of electronics would sit there, and then he would sit there with chains and beat the tables in the front of the audience about where you're sitting and yell at people on the mic. There was a comedian that influenced him, and we're talking about the folk influence, was a folk comedian named Brother Theodore, who was involved in the 50s. Look him up on the internet if you want to. But he was this guy who was actually Austrian. And he went to New York and had an Austrian accent. And he used to do clubs and antagonize people in the clubs in New York in the 50s and go right up in their face and be horrible to them. And this influenced Alan Vega a lot. So he continued this tradition going. I went back to the people at the record company that sent me to the first band and said, look, this is real New York folk music. This is what you should be doing. This is great. You should sign this band Suicide. Forget about, I don't even remember the name of the other band. They said, don't call us, we'll call you. And I didn't have a job at the record company for wanting to sign a band called Suicide. Luckily, I got to work for another record company called Sire Records, which was a little independent label at the time that was versed in folk music in New York, as well as importers of European avant-garde and electronic and pop music, which people don't realize there's a whole history of Sire before punk and Madonna, where they had some of the folk singers from the 1960s that I was speaking about, and they had a number of bands from England and Germany and Austria and as well. I don't think anybody from Czechoslovakia, unfortunately. But they may have, actually, but I can't remember the name of the band that was put out a record on Sire. It might be. But in any case, when I heard Suicide, I thought there was a scene in New York that was continuing a tradition where people were going to listen to things like that. And to me, it was going to continue very similar to what Harry Smith and the other people were doing, that they were going to continue this New York radical tradition. And so I started looking for other artists that might be doing that. I wanted to sign Patti Smith to Sire Records, and she wouldn't do it, rightfully so, because at the time Sire was woefully small, and she already had a relationship with an A&R guy who went to work for Clive Davis and Arista Records, and that's where she went. But then somebody at CBGB's, Hilly Crystal, who was the fellow who booked it, along with a guy named Terry Ork, who ran a shop in managed a band called Television that he was absolutely enamored with, booked CBGBs. And they said, well, both those guys said, look, you can't have Patti Smith, okay? Come down and hang out. There's a lot of bands playing here. Be very particularly pay attention to a band called the Ramones. So I saw the Ramones, and they evoked the same thing as Suicide in me, that they were going back to the roots of what rock and roll was all about, which essentially is folk communication. It's telling people about their lives and having it be important in somebody else's life, who then makes something out of it their own, and then goes on and influences somebody else to do their version of it. And I said that regardless of anything, we'd have to somehow get the Ramones to make a record, which was not the easiest thing in the world. At that point, they never ended a song. They were totally an art project, literally. They would start a song and keep playing little segments of it until they broke down in a fight, and then the set was over because they couldn't decide what the next song was. And it was real. It was honest. It wasn't a show. They actually were that impassioned about what they did. And I said, well, anybody that's that impassioned, I want to work with. And is that funny? That's the other thing. And communicates something alternative and radical. So after a while, I worked with them for a while. We went through all kinds of political things to get them a manager and this and that. They later got a guy named Danny Fields, who Sire helped get, and the wife of the guy who owned Sire helped him come in, and then decided to go manage the band with him. And eventually they were signed about a year after I had first spoken to the label. It wasn't a lightning bolt from heaven that said, we're signing this important band. It was something that people worked on for a very long time to try and get down, which would mainly be Tommy Ramone, the drummer, Danny Fields and me, and various journalists that would bombard Seymour Stein, the head of the label, with messages about how great the Ramones were. Now, when we did the thing with the Ramones, it had no, very similar to Silver Apples and the things with Harry Smith and the things with the initial reactions to Suicide and things like that, is it sold wildly well in the south of New York, which was this intellectual artistic hub. It sold and communicated to virtually no one in the rest of the United States or the world at that point, which is something people don't actually know. They could fill CBGBs, which was the club where they were found, that was the hive of all of these bands, but they couldn't play across the border in another state. They would play Connecticut, opening up a concert for a rock artist, Johnny Winter, I think they did one for, and they would get bottles and things thrown at them and told to go off the stage, and they weren't able to communicate because they were so radical for the time. However, they did find their audience, and this is where the folk music thing comes in. They would play tours to very small audiences in places all across the United States, riding in a bus. And wherever they'd play, they might sell a few records of that album that we did, the first album that I produced. But invariably, there would be five people in the audience, and four of them would decide, I think I'm going to start a band of my own because this is so cool. This is what I need to be doing. And I think anybody can do this, you know? And that's what the folk music, that's why I was calling this thing about the folk music of New York. It was a reaction where the spark of the sound from New York actually created bands and pockets all around. And eventually, the Ramones made it to England because there was a very wise A&R guy for the distributor for our record company, Nigel Grange, and David Bates, two of them, at Phonogram in London, that said they wanted to bring out the Ramones' first album in England, because there was a scene starting in England that was similar, that wasn't quite focused, but they thought the Ramones would belong in it and would be helpful to that audience. So they put the record out. The Ramones went and did their first gig in London at the Roundhouse Theater as an opening act. And people had spread by word of mouth that this was something from America that was going to be important to people that were disenchanted with rock music, different, disenchanted with politics, disenchanted with what was going on. And virtually 50% of the bands that came out of the so-called punk movement in England were in attendance at that gig and saw the Ramones. People like U2 came over from Ireland and decided to start their own band when they saw the Ramones. And this started spreading all around the world to various different places, where that music that was fostered in New York started a tradition that's still going. This also happened mainly because of communications, because of the internet, which later came in, to all the genres. I mean, the dance scene molded with the European scene, and you had really interesting electronic music started coming out of the continent in Europe and then making its way back to America, influencing American artists to do what they did. So we started, like, there was this worldwide capitalization on what was basically a local scene in a couple of places. And the Ramones were catalysts for it. Suicide was, when they did very similar. They came to Belgium for one of their first concerts. They had bottles and glasses, everything under the sun thrown at them to try and get them off the stage. They were playing for a punk audience, too. They were playing for The Clash. And that was something that people didn't expect, but the punk audience didn't take to them. Their manager very wisely recorded it. It's an extra track on one of their albums these days of the riot of them playing in Brussels. But in any case, the spread of the New York scene and everything created what was happening that happened later in other places. And the bands that came up, not just the ones that I did, but the other ones that came up, I mean, worked very early on trying to get Talking Heads signed to Sire, which we eventually did. But that was another band that actually influenced a lot of other people when they heard it. And basically, that's the story of the New York spreading of folk music from the very original foundations of Harry Smith and his anthology of American folk music to what came later. The Ramones had homage to that. If you look at when I said way back that Harry Smith produced a band called The Fugs and did their first album as a producer in 1964, if you go look at the album sleeve on that, The Fugs are standing on a wall in the East Village in black and white on a cover where they're sitting with their instruments and they're standing. The Ramones' first album cover is them standing at that wall. So people didn't know. It wasn't just a random wall. And so people knew what they were doing and were trying to carry something forward, even if they were doing it with humor and not trying to influence anybody in any way to do anything except do their own thing, which was the hippie thing in the 60s. And punk actually came out of that in England. There was no punk scene in New York. It's a misnomer. There was a magazine called Punk Magazine, which had a lot of influence, caused people to call things punk. But all of the New York bands thought that they were being avant-garde artists of some kind, and that they weren't part of any scene. But in actuality, they were part of a mentality that grew. And with the internet, happened that you can now hear the fruits of what that music and what rock and roll was Everywhere. I mean, it's ubiquitous now. You hear it at Eurovision. You hear it in schoolrooms. Little children in Korea are singing Ramones songs. You know, so you get this thing where it had a big influence, and it's been important to me that, and believe me, 50 some odd years ago, when I was first stumbling upon these artists, I honestly didn't have any idea that they would create such an influence. You know, I thought that they were important musically and sociologically, as were all these other scenes in New York. The hip hop scene uptown New York was equally important. Afrika Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash, and those people were influencing the European electronic bands, who in turn influenced them. When they heard Kraftwerk, they went crazy and sampled it and put it on their records. So it started this cross-pollinization of cultures, which is kind of what we have on the internet now, where anything goes. And Blondie was another band that I worked with that was able to take all of the influences I just mentioned and very carefully construct their own sound, made up from different pieces of all of these roots of them, from 1960s pop, girl groups, not so much jazz, but hip-hop, and of course the avant-garde sounds and the kind of hard rock sounds that were coming out of CBGBs and all of that. So all in all, it's an interesting recap to see how that actually spread. And it's something to wonder where that's going to go now in the future. I wonder, there's two ways you can look at it. Is there a future for that type of communication, or is everything now too diverse and too much in a manufactured spectrum, which is what most pop music is? And in a way, do you go, okay, is Taylor Swift something that's manufactured, or is Taylor Swift an outgrowth of somebody doing their own thing by being influenced by people who came before them? She was heavily influenced, although musically you wouldn't know it. She was heavily influenced by Beyoncé, who was heavily influenced by all of the New York hip-hop bands. So you can't say it's still not happening, and it can be happening. And have any of you ever, did you ever start bands or be in bands or create music? Or yeah. You're just fans? Yes? Yeah, have you, what provoked you to actually start a band?
What do you mean?
Did you start a band or create music?
More like a collective that were invested very much in music. So we were mostly DJing and producing my own music, trying to express myself.
Yeah, what music actually influenced you? You're from here.
Yeah.
What music influenced you when you
all
first
you've
decided?
Already.
Hmm?
All you've said that influenced
everybody that I've said.
Yeah.
Well, what the hell? We have one guy who's that's great.
Except.
We actually did something. I'm really, really glad we did all of this in New York then. And I went all those nights sitting at CBGB's, having to go, oh my God, I'm listening to 80 crap bands, but then here comes the B-52s, whoa, you know, or Devo. yeah, I mean, those bands, I was very lucky, even with the ones that I didn't work with, that I got to meet and know. All of those bands were, because of what we're talking about, were drawn by the same thing you did. They
and
heard.
I would like to add that you influenced me.
I did?
Yeah.
Why, did you want to produce because of me, or did you want to make a record that sounded like my weird stuff?
Yeah, I saw future in as you work with some tribal influences into folk music.
Oh, I got to hear your music. okay, we'll switch focus, because what I'll do now is I'm telling you stuff that you already know and you guys probably already know, and you may have been humoring an old guy listening to this stuff. But let's go to the Anthology of Interplanetary Folk Music, which is the thing that I worked on, which, oh, it's related to Harry's first thing, the Anthology of American Folk Music. I was very influenced by Harry Smith and by the classical music that I studied and the avant-garde music that I studied. I was a weird kid. I used to sit in Florida and I'd ride away to a big record store and get Stockhausen records and go play them in my bedroom, you know, when I was really younger. And I was going, yeah, this is the life for me. Little did I know. But in any case, I incorporated that into the attitude of the punk rock music and the stuff that I was, the New York avant-garde stuff. And I created my own little bit of folk music. And it went back to a story. I'll have to tell you the whole story. I don't know how much time I've been eating here. But if we have time, I can tell you a little bit about it. Tell me to stop when I have to stop for the other talk, and I'll shut up. But if you're interested, I can tell you this. I hope you are. In any case, Harry Smith did this thing called the Anthology of American Folk Music. And his premise, he was a very wise person. He studied alchemy, which is a tradition in this country, for many, 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 many years. He was also a bit of a shaman. He studied American Indian traditions and such, and he incorporated that into his anthology of American folk music because he wanted to magically bless, and I'm just saying this is what he said. I'm not saying this is what he did, but this is what he set out to do, to make an anthology of 40 pieces of music from all different racial, ethnic, and countries, people from all over who made up the American psyche, which again, from what I'm talking about now, went on to influence everything in the world from where these people actually came from originally. So Harry said if he did the right thing and he put the right music and the right sounds and the right art together, people would know that it didn't matter because racial differences, ethnic differences, all the things that are bothering us right today still would disappear eventually. Eventually, he said, it wasn't fast. He said the first step of that it was going to be, and this is something he disclosed, it's not something that he actually published, but I'll just say that it's a rumor that he said this, that in 1951, he said, if I got this right, within 50 years, we'll have a black president in the United States, which is something that was unheard of in 1951 and probably unheard of till Obama actually came along. Whether he really was able to do that with this book of music that carried all these people that started singing music from black culture, European culture, Southern American culture, all of that as one unified thing, then he was successful. So I took off from that when I went to make the record that you're talking about with the tribal influences and all of that. It was because I had found a art exhibition in 1973 or 74 of a tribe in Africa that all of their art that was on exhibition over many, many, many hundreds of years and thousands of years, all depicted one race of people that they said, or beings, that influenced them in much the way that we treat angels in our society, as people that came down and taught them how to, basically taught them the rules of civilization. And they had complicated dealings with all of this. And one of the most complicated things that they had was that they said they were able in some way to communicate with these people mentally from the other planet. They said came, and they found out they came from another planet. And that when asked where they came from, they drew a star map, which is in a lot of these artworks that I saw. Interesting thing is that when the star maps were made, you couldn't see this one planetary system, which is unique in the cosmos, from the from the naked eye at the time that these art pieces were made, so that somebody must have told them that. We don't know if it was corrupted a little later or whatever. Doesn't matter. It made a great story for me to hang on, that what I wanted to do was create the folk music of the mythical people that these guys were talking about. What did they hear on their planet that they first brought back to Earth? So I made an album that was very, very tribal, like the earliest African music I could imagine. And then I did everything in pentatonic scales, blending together. I did multitudes of pentatonic scales, not just one. And did it over drones that were electronic, that were very watery sounding, because again, one of the attributes of these beings from another planet is that they were water people. So basically, in the end, that's what I'm doing. I'm going to play some of that tonight, and the follow the second part of that album, which is more or less about the music traveling through ancient places, starting off in Africa and then going on to other places and then going back out again. But maybe 50 years from now, we'll have somebody with another mindset, like what the alien people were teaching this tribe, that becomes a ruler of importance on our planet, like Obama did because of the Anthology of American Folk Music. So the Anthology of Interplanetary Folk Music is what the man at the record label who let me make that record and set, and myself decided that's what we were going to subtitle what I'm doing. So you're looking at two results here at least, and people who are at least interested in what was started during New York, you know. And I think if anybody wants to ask anything more in specific about it, please ask me, because I've kind of said all I can say without going into much more depth that will take much longer than I think however little I have left to talk here. Do I have time here?
Just a question. It's quite
terrible. A little bit.
Just a bit?
Some questions.
10, 20 minutes, 5 minutes, doesn't matter. But we'll probably have to wrap up soon. But in any case, anything you want to talk about, anything, any of
maybe,
the bands,
maybe
what kind of hot dogs did they sell in New York, you know, whatever you'd like.
Talk about John Fay.
John Fay. Do you guys know the name John Fay?
I do. Yeah.
One guy does. John Fay, he was an American record collector who is really important because he was one of the people who was the most influenced in the 1950s and 60s by the same music that Harry Smith had on the American Anthology of American Folk Music. Black music and American country music and avant-garde music. And he combined all of those into a sound of his own. And he created a record label where he put out his own records, which you should hear on the internet. John Fahey, if you haven't heard it, F-A-H-E-Y. He's got many, many records. I recommend starting with the earliest ones and then going to the ones that are on Vanguard over in Europe later, that are more of the esoteric ones, the ones with synths. He actually did synth records, but he was primarily a guitar player. He signed me to his label to do the... Okay, talk about that. What a visionary. You know, I envy him the sales we had on that album in the first year. But in any case, I'm just joking. It did a little better than the bands from New York because it got a lot of classical airplay in America and it sold about 10,000 records, which is astounding for what it was. But in any case, John loved the idea of the Anthology of Interplanetary Folk Music carrying on from the albums that he loved, the Anthology of Interplanetary Folk Music. And that's how I got to even get those records out. You know, it's through him and his manager mainly, as well, Denny Bruce, who is another really an esoteric figure for American rock and roll and pop. But that's John Fahey for now, I think, without hearing the music. Yeah, anything else?
Maybe if you have ever visited, not physically, but maybe just spiritually, the Dogon tribe, as that was the tribe that your Nomos LP was based on, right?
Which one?
Dogon tribe.
I've never visited them because of a couple of things. I'll tell you about the Dogon. What made me one of the happiest guys in the world was...
I lied.
You know, two different things really made me think, okay, I didn't waste too much of my life, was that I now see that the Ramones have about 160 million plays on the album that I did on the internet streaming, which makes me about 8 cents, but I don't really care. That's how many people are listening to it. So that theory of what I was saying worked in some way. And then the second thing was that there were people in the Dogon community who got and understood my record, which was totally made of my imagination. I wasn't trying to make the music of the Dogon. I was trying to make my impression on a science fiction level of the music of the beings that they were talking about. What did those guys listen to on their version of a Walkman when they were coming 20 light years somehow to go help, of all people, they come to help the Dogon, you know, which is the chosen people, I guess. I have no idea. But in any case, several people asked to make collaborations from Dogon people that were living in Paris, and I couldn't do it. They came very much at the time of the pandemic, and we never followed it up. But one of my favorite things besides the Ramones was that the Cultural Institute of Mali government added me and still has me on their Twitter or X feed. So I guess they acknowledge me. So that's the only close ties I've had with them. I've wanted so much to go. But as an American citizen, and if you see what happens, right now Mali has been in horrible shape for many, many, many years. And Americans, basically the American government says, if you're American, even though I'm European as well, luckily, I was European until the place I was living in decided to be stupid. Oh, erase that. No, but in any case, American government says, go to Mali at your own risk because you're probably going to die. Well,
that's not worth it.
We're all going to die anyway, but I'd rather not do that. So I haven't ever gone there, although I really have appreciated their culture. And my second album of the anthology, The Canon, which I'm playing most of tonight, actually takes upon the spreading of this early Dogon music, so to speak, how it actually turned from Dogon music into the roots of Western music and philosophy. That's a whole other explanation for why that one exists. You'll have to go on the internet and see it, because I think I'm probably running out of time to keep talking. Or
you've got like 5 minutes.
Oh, I do? Okay. 5 minute recap. Do you know the other album, The Canon, that I did?
And The Visiting?
No. There's Nomos and Visiting makeup. Then there's volume 2 that I put out in 2019, called The Canon, which is based on a book that was written in 1897. I collect books a lot. And I bought one at a book stand in the town near where I live. And it was the writings of an architect from 1897 in a small edition of books. And in it, he said, I have the formulas for all of the art and all of the music and all of the philosophy and anything that's ever influenced Western civilization. And he had it all in his compilation album of these things. That was very popular stuff in the 1890s. There were a lot of people trying to collect that and collect all sorts of folk music. There's a guy named James, and folk anecdotes and facts, like the James Fraser was collecting things under the name of the Golden Bough, which came out a little bit after that, which talked about all of the traditions of superstition and belief in all the tribes of the world. It's a big, big set. But this guy had one book. So I read the book, and I was looking at the mathematical formulas. He said everything was based on mathematics. And he had formulas that he took from ancient Egypt to make a long story short, these, or longer in case you want to go research it, which I think you should, the ancient Egyptian things he was quoting are the same as what the oral tradition of the Dogon are in their overall religious viewpoint, which is a whole other discovery that they didn't divulge to anybody except one archaeologist who wrote it up as in a book about meetings with the elders of the Dogons. And in there, it's all the same religious hierarchy, the same numerology, the same things that are in ancient Egypt. Now, whether ancient Egypt influenced them, because they're not too far away, or they influenced ancient Egypt, whatever it did influence all of the, what I would call the underground thinkers that are in this book, The Canon, that go all the way through European and Eastern philosophy. So basically, that's the follow-up to that. It's an interesting book. You can find it on the internet. But I think that, it's hard going. It's hard going in English. So I don't think it's ever been translated. But there's a lot of the same principles are kept in libraries, and I don't have time to talk about the library, but that's coming in the future. But in any case, that's pretty much what what you can expect from the canon, and hopefully it'll lead on to the next thing. And eventually, a lot of those people that are mentioned in those philosophies that are mentioned in the canon were taken by the Beat Generation writers who lived in Greenwich Village in New York, who influenced all of the musicians I'm talking about and the avant-garde thing. William S. Burroughs, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, that whole bunch, were heavily influenced by the same writers that were influenced by the sources that are in the book, The Canon. And so we still have that going now. But you have a lot of that tradition in the Czech Republic, because Prague was one of the outposts of that way of thinking for years and years and years and years. It's on all the buildings. You can see it's just the same thing that's in the canon. It's all over your everyday life if you're living in Prague. So basically, that's it. That's what New York did to me. I hope it did something worthwhile, and I hope whatever you do can influence people to do something equally strange. Okay, I think we'll give some time to Christian probably to do his bit, yeah? Or do we have a break and then he comes?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, any other questions? If I can sit here, one thing about me is I'll talk for 10 days. So yeah, go ahead, please. Anything you want to know, even if I don't know the answer, I'll tell you. But I don't know the answer to everything, but there's a few things I think I do. But yeah,
I have a question about the influences. You said the music of Suicide and what you did was mostly informed by folk music. And for me, there were like two major movements coming out from New York or US in general, maybe 5-10 years before Suicide came out, let's say.
Yeah.
And that was minimalism and spiritual jazz. Music of like Pharos Andrews, Terry Riley, Don Cherry.
Yeah, that what I call the actual avant-garde scene.
Yeah.
And Don was somebody who bridged
part of the avant-garde scene. It was a part of the same scene in New York.
Yes, it was actually. It was the avant-garde scene in New York. Two of the people that you actually mentioned there. Don Cherry was, Terry Riley was working a lot in New York, and he was influential on me at the time, and on John Cale, and a lot of other people. He lives in California now. I don't know how long he's lived in California, but he's still going. And those two things were very influential on Suicide, along with, though, what they brought to the party was their love of every genre that I mentioned that was happening in New York right at that time, and their love of the band Silver Apples, which was a pop band that incorporated a lot of that stuff in the 1960s. And Marty and I did some shows together, which kind of were everything that this lecture is about. He made an album that I put out on my label that did so well as an avant-garde label that it went broke after three records. But look at my choices. The classical music of George Martin, conducted by me, played by the Berlin Phil. Big seller. I won a German Grammy, but it sold about 8 records. A French minimalist artist named Béranger Maximin, who had a wonderful record that sold in suicide-type quantities. And Marty Rev's album, Demolition 9, which you should look up, which was his music about the roots of what he formulated for the music beds of suicide. And it's 41-minute tracks on a vinyl album that show all of these influences from everybody we've just mentioned. He shows doo-wop, he shows Puerto Rican music, he shows old rock and roll music from white sources, from country. He shows the classical minimalists that you were speaking about. And Alan Vega and he were very much, and still are, Alan isn't with us, but Marty still is, part of the minimalist movement, which was to try and do as big an impact as possible by doing as little physically as possible. So it's like, it's not really slacker, because it takes a lot of work to think to how, and the Ramones were part of that as well, how they could be the most influential doing the least, and the most manipulative by doing the least, seemingly the least amount of effort to actually do it. But a lot of effort went into what they did. I know that. And I know for Marty and Alan, a lot of effort went into what they did. They were really great artists. If you can ever see, if you look on the internet, the artwork of Alan Vega from Suicide, he's pretty up there with a lot of the spiritual avant-garde artists from the French movements and the European movements in the 20s and 30s. That went later into time in Europe, and he belongs in there, and so does Marty Rev, actually. Marty Rev belongs in that group that you were talking about of minimalists as well. I'm glad you brought that up. That's really nice. You're spot on with that, you know, because that's exactly where it came from. Yeah, that's them. Trying to think of anything else I can talk about quickly. Castle can come and talk about her meetings with William S. Burroughs and stuff before I did. But there's my wife who's here, who has actually been my partner in music for about 40 years. Before she was my wife, secondarily she was my wife. She's originally my partner in music. She's sitting over here. She'll be playing tonight as well. And she comes from the Texas psychedelic scene, out of Austin, Texas, and Houston, Texas. And she worked with rock bands that were spiritually into the same thing as the New York bands, but they didn't quite make the same sort of music, and they gravitated more towards Los Angeles. But she worked with Rocky Erickson and the 13th Floor Elevators, Mayo Thompson and Red Crayola, and a number of those bands. She went on to have a day job and sing with Willie Nelson and Jeff Walker and a number of other people. Blondie, she sung on Maria that I produced and several other Blondie records. But Bill Burroughs at the Bug House, right? You want to, there you go.
I've been carrying with him for many years.
Yeah, that's good. He influenced you, so did Alan.
Well, so did this man.
Yeah.
So we've made albums together. Oh, I have 4 albums.
I mean,
I'm on a totally different, slightly different round singing in a different way.
Yeah.
Tell some similar stories.
That's it. Another track you could listen to, especially as we all grow older, that I think sums up a lot of the American folk music tradition, the minimalist movement, the spiritual movement, the existential beat poet movement and the alchemy and Eastern philosophy, all of that in one little song, is a little thing with harmonium and voice, and it's one of my favorite records, and it's a record very few people actually know. It's called Father Death Blues, and it's sung by Allen Ginsberg. And write that one down if you don't know it, and find a recording of it. It says in it a lot of the Eastern philosophy, the Dogon philosophy, and the philosophies of all of those things on a personal level, on a poem that he made up while he was traveling to his father's funeral and thought about what do we do on earth and what does all this religion and everything mean to us. And if we're so motivated, maybe we'll sing it tonight if we have enough time. But it's a brilliant piece of music, and I'd like you to consider.
Beautiful opening. Oh, Father Death.
I'm coming home.
I'm coming home. Oh, Father.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And
that is what he sang. And as Allen Ginsberg sings, I don't know, as a true poet, he was a guy that would sing all the time. He made a lot of albums of him singing. Another album, if I can get you back to, again, the Enlightenment tradition and Allen Ginsberg, I don't know how I got off on him, but I might as well. Double album set on vinyl, I think it's up on the internet, is Allen Ginsberg sings the songs of William Blake, the poet, and he sings Blake, which is another one, and All the Hills Echoed, and all of that. But in any case, we can go on. It's an ongoing tradition is what the key to that all means, and I'd probably want to leave you with that for a minute. Again, unless you want to throw another question at me, I'll gladly do it. But if I'm running out of, I keep thinking I'm running out of time. I don't want to step on anybody else's toes time-wise. But in any case, God, we covered everything from the Dogon to Allen to Rocky Erickson. It's about all I can do in an hour. I'm sorry. and thanks for listening to me, and I hope it clarified some of the things that you might have been thinking about, or hope I'd even feel better if I just told you a bunch of stuff you already knew. So there you go. Well, that's good. Well, I think that's about it for me. Thank you. Thanks for paying attention.